Last week, if you recall, we talked about the schism of the church between the East and the West and how all of that came about, which brought us up to the period of 1054. What we're going to do this morning is we're going to cover that time span from 1054 up to the period of the Reformation. So that's about 450, 500 years. And as we go through this morning, we're going to do a little bit of a historical background again. Hopefully you're not going to get too bored with it. I keep trying to add another slide on these maps and everything so that you don't get too bored. But I have found that visual repetition does seem to help solidify things in your mind. So hopefully, as we go through this, there's not too much repetition. But please try to pay attention this morning as we move through this, because about midway through the presentation, I've got a number of questions that I would like to ask and see if we could get some discussion going as to why some of the things happened that they did. It's one thing to look back in history and see that they happened, but it's also easy to look back in history and dismiss something that happened as either they were fools, they were stupid, or, gosh, if I was back then, I wouldn't have done that. Well, we tend to be pretty arrogant when it comes to those kind of things. So I want us to stop and think a little bit. And also, hopefully, I want you to see, too, that if you get a basic premise wrong somewhere, that because we're very logical people, once we get a premise wrong, we tend to begin to extrapolate from that false premise, and all of a sudden, you get more and more error that creeps in. And I think as we talk about the church, I think you'll see that that is kind of what's happened. So, what you see on the screen, sacraments, crusades, and inquisitions. Sounds like an odd combination, doesn't it? But what I'm hoping to do this morning is to show you there is a connection between these. We probably won't spend a whole lot of time on the Crusades and the Inquisitions. We'll get to talk about it a little bit. If we don't, then I'll try to cover it next week if we don't get time to talk about it. So let's get started. Sacraments. This is the sacrament of the Eucharist in the Roman Catholic Church. And as you can see, remember Paul talked last week, I believe, about the elements, holding the elements up as opposed to holding them down. Because what you see here, the elements, once they've been consecrated by the priest, become the body and blood of Christ. Premise: temporal power plus sacraments equals crusades, inquisitions, and corruption. What do I mean when I say temporal power?
Man-made power?
Power of the government. Power of the government as opposed to the power of the church. Remember last time I showed you two pictures, one of the Pope and one of the King, the Holy Roman Emperor. One holds the sword, the other one holds the keys to the kingdom. But when you put those two together, that's what we've been talking about. As the Roman popes began to assimilate power underneath them, not only spiritual power, but also the power of the sword, the power of the government. And although they did not wield it directly, they had so much influence over the temporal power that in essence they did control the sword. And that's where these kinds of things begin to come from. Again, logical conclusions from bad assumptions to start with. All right, here's the map we've been looking at for weeks and weeks now. This is the apex of the Roman Empire that goes all the way up into Britain up here, Spain, across the northern Africa, up through the Middle East, through Greece and Italy. Then we move into the Eastern and Western Roman Empires. Remember, they were split into two pieces, still part of the Roman Empire, but theologically they were beginning to separate just a little bit. And the Roman Empire itself, the western part, was beginning to fall apart over here, as you can see. That was in 476 when Rome fell. Then we have the rise of Islam all the way up into Spain, across all of northern Africa, Saudi Arabia, and over here in the Middle East. And as you can see, right there is Constantinople. So this represented basically what was left of the Eastern Empire. And here we have that. right here. Here's Constantinople. All of this is Islamic over here now. You have various tribes over here. And the Eastern Empire takes a little bit of the boot of Italy over here. That's in 867. Then the Eastern Empire manages to gain back some territory right around the Baltic Sea over here. And then we have the conversion of the Slavs. That is basically the Russian area. And remember, a lot of times when you see the Russian churches, you'll see the minarets and those, or the, I'm not sure exactly what you call them, but the things on top of those churches. So that was in 1054, and that's where we left off last week, was 1054, and we talked about why the church separated between the East and the West. There were some theological differences, and now we're going to see some things that further drive a wedge between the East and the West. So you have theological differences that we talked about last week. Then we said, okay, the Vikings, the Magyars, and the Islamic invaders all began to attack these areas around in here. The Vikings were pretty far-ranging because of the ships that they had. They were able to attack in many different places across what used to be the Roman Empire. Magyars would come in periodically and attack here, and the Muslims would come in from underneath. And that's also why today there's, and the Muslims would also come up into Spain, and they were in Spain for a long period of time. There was also a big enclave of Jews in Spain. That was one of the places that the Jews went to once they were thrown out of Palestine. They went to Spain. Little quick recap on history. 30 to 362, we have the movement away from Jerusalem. The church was being dispersed out into the world because of either persecutions and the fall of Jerusalem. And a time of explosive growth. The persecutions were going on, but even in the midst of horrible persecution, the church grew. And we grew in spite of that. And grew because of it. Remember, the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. And I think we've forgotten that. After 363, Christianity finally became a state religion. So in a little over 300 years, you have a religion that was just 12 men in a small little country all of a sudden has now become the state religion. In 381, it becomes the exclusive religion of the Roman Empire. In 392, then paganism is prohibited and it becomes a punishable offense. Do you see how things have almost flipping 180 degrees from where they were before? 476 to 800, the church attempts to fill the void left by Rome and evangelizes the barbarians. That was a good thing. The barbarians came in and destroyed the temporal power of the Roman Empire, but the church still existed. In God's providence, the church continued to exist, and it grew in its power. And it reached out and evangelized the barbarians. And there were many. Now, some were converted by mass conversions. Well, you would come in and I'll hold a sword up to you and say, you're now a Christian. Okay, that's one way to make a Christian. But through true evangelization, and remember we talked about the monastic movement and how many of those people were part of that evangelistic movement, and they reached out to many of these barbarian tribes and they did convert to Christianity. So God has His people, even in the midst of error and horrific circumstances, God's Spirit is still at work bringing His people to Himself. In 1054, we have the schism of the Eastern and Western churches, which we talked about last week. 1054 to 1294, this is the kind of half of this 500-year period that I'm going to talk about this morning. The Western Church gains power. It tries to liberate the Holy Lands through the Crusades and tries to root out heretics through the power of the Inquisition. Then from 1294 to 1500, the papacy went into a decline. There were attempts at internal reform, and the rise of the nation states, such as England and France and others. So all of these things begin to combine and begin to come up, hopefully, into a period that you're going to be a little more familiar with as we move into Reformation next week. hopefully these things will become a little more familiar with you, to you. But hopefully you began to appreciate where the church we know today, where it came from, what are its roots, and this is what we're talking about here. All right, on this slide, just going back through the councils real quickly, and over here on the right, this C stands for the Catholic Church, the E is for the Eastern Church, and the P stands for Protestants. There weren't any Protestants back then, but I'm just saying today when we look back on those councils, the ones in green are saying that those groups agree with the councils and the outcomes of those councils. The first one was the first Nicaea. Remember, it declared the Son homoi, ousios, co-equal, co-substantial, and co-eternal with the Father. We've talked a lot about that. The next was Constantinople. It affirmed the deity of the Holy Spirit. They covered the Father and the Son, and now they were talking about the Holy Spirit. In 431, the Council of Ephesus condemned Pelagius and the Nestorians. And we'll talk a little bit more about Pelagius because that becomes important later on. And you can see the Catholic Church agrees with this at this point. They are in agreement with this, as we are. Then you have Chalcedon, declared that Christ's two natures were unmixed. And we've talked a lot about that as well. Unchanged, undivided, and inseparable. He's fully God and fully man. Constantinople in 553, again, condemned the supporters of Nestorian. It was like a cancer. It just didn't die. It just continued on. Constantinople in 681 condemned the Monothelites. They believed that Christ had only one will. He had these two natures, but only one will. So they were again trying to mix things up a little bit. Second Council of Nicaea in 787. Now you notice some different colors over there on the right-hand side. Declared veneration of icons and statues legitimate. We talked about the iconoclastic controversy a couple of weeks ago. The reason this one over here is sort of pinkish...
They had to make up their mind.
No, actually they did. The thing that they had a problem with was statues. Remember a week or two ago I said that they agreed with the veneration of icons. Not the worship, but the veneration. But the veneration of those icons, but not statues. The Roman church said the statues are okay too. So that was a slight difference between them. But at this point, you can see the Protestants depart. And will depart from here forward. Constantinople in 870, they deposed Photius, who was the Eastern Patriarch. The Roman Church took it upon itself. Now, they were coming up to the split eventually, but this is another thing that just irritated the people in the East because this council deposed Photius as Patriarch, but they affirmed Second Nicaea, which they said definitely veneration of icons is okay. Then we have what's called Lateran I. If you go from this last one here, 870 to 1123, I think there were some minor councils in between there, but there was a big gap in there during the Dark Ages when, remember we talked about the feudal system a lot last week, where you had the various little fiefdoms throughout there. There was really no central government, although there was still the central church. A lot of its power was dispersed throughout the lands because you had each one of these manors were sort of self-sufficient. They had their own church, they had their own priest. Although they were still reporting to the Pope in Rome, there was more of a decentralized connection between them. It wasn't the cohesive centrality that there is today, or even as we're going to talk about this morning, as the power of the papacy increases. In this first Lateran Council in 1123, they forbade marriage of priests. I want you to look at some of these. This is where some of the stuff that exists today, this is when this came about, was during this time frame. And they granted indulgences to the Crusaders. We'll talk about indulgences a little bit later on. Lateran II, 1139, and confirmed Lateran I. Lateran III condemned Catharism, which was dualistic and Gnostic, and the followers were later destroyed by the Crusaders. The Catharists were the Albigensians.
You're picking the easy words.
Yes, I know. And the Waldensians, mainly the Albigensians. This is in southern France and northern Italy. The Waldensians are kind of in northern Italy. The Albigensians are in southern France. They began to see that there were problems in the church. And they tried to separate themselves. And they actually were able to get a hold of some Bibles that had actually been translated into a more common language. And actually, because of them, eventually the church came along with another council and actually said, if that's the case, then we're going to take the Bible out of the hands of the people. So they forbade the use of the Bible by the laity. That's how you get that today. Now, the church is, I think, has eased up a bit on that today because I know some people, but we had a next-door neighbor that we had for many, many years, and she was so surprised when the church allowed them to start reading the Bible on their own. Then Lateran IV, this was a big, big deal. They established the Inquisition. They defined the doctrine of transubstantiation. Now, just because they're defining it here doesn't mean that it wasn't already in practice. Many of the things that happened in these councils, they were just affirming what had already been going on for many, many years. So it wasn't just like this became a light bulb at this point. These were things that had been going on, and they were affirming what was actually happening. So you have the doctrine of transubstantiation. They denounced the Magna Carta. So now you're beginning to hear some familiar terms, hopefully, that you're not worried about.
Huh? What did they have to do with them?
They didn't submit the civil government to the religious government.
Exactly.
It established the two kingdoms mentality of government.
Mm-hmm. And the nation state was beginning to rear its head as well, because previously you had these little manors that were all over the place, but the church still had control of that. But and we'll talk a little bit more, as a result of the Crusades and other things, that began to break down, and you had the emergence of things like France and England, where you had a king as opposed to individual people.
The civil government was starting to take over from the spiritual government.
That's exactly right.
And all of this is a period of, remember I said before that when you're operating under fear, you make really bad decisions. So most of these councils are, the Catholic Church is afraid because these groups will see something that's not right. They'll correctly identify the problem, but then their solution is almost always bad. So, like when you talk about Catharism, they were wrong. They identified the problem correctly, but their solution was wrong. But the church's way of correcting that is always way falling off the other side of the horse. And so that's what you see through all of this. It's an overreaction to mistakes.
Now, to that point, they did send in some of the folks from the monastery, some of the various orders. They did try to send to the Albigensians and try and convince them first before they killed them. So at least they gave him a chance. Okay. Yes, ma'am.
One other thing, they were practicing, these other groups, believers' baptism. They were refusing, if I understand correctly, infant baptism. And so the church, they saw people practicing believers' baptism.
It wasn't just practicing believers' baptism. It was denying the validity of the Roman Catholic baptism. And so that became a real point of disagreement, was they were saying that these people who had been baptized by the church as infants were not validly baptized.
But they also were into Gnosticism and a dualistic approach to the Godhead and stuff. It's you know, the materialism was bad. The spiritual things were good, and, you know, never the twain shall meet, that kind of thing.
What are we talking about?
The Albigensians.
How about the Waldensians?
They were a little different. They were a little bit more the forerunner of the Protestant Puritan type of group. Not totally, but they actually were a little closer to what Protestantism actually turned out to be at some point. And in fact, I think they still exist today.
Yeah, they were making fewer theological claims than corruption and immorality claims. We don't want to be connected to this immorality.
Right.
They weren't really, the Waldensians weren't really trying to precisely define doctrines.
It is telling about these an hour west of here, founded by the Waldensians. I'm curious about that.
I'm not sure. And again, they prepared for the Fifth Crusade. So Lateran IV was a big deal. So what was the result of this prior history? We talked about this before, a secularization of the church, because you had the government interfering in the church. The church was now owning land, so it kind of got diffused and had to concentrate on keeping the land and so forth. We talked about that last week. The worship became more aristocratic. That was when you had the hats and the robes and the pageantry and everything else that came about. And part of that was because of bringing pagan influences into the church. And again, sharply drawn distinctions between the clergy and the laity, which we're going to talk about in just a few minutes as to why one of the sacraments is it the way it is. Then you have mass conversions. Nominal Christians bought into the church as well as some paganization. And that's also, remember, why the icons began to come into the church was this pagan influence. When you have nominal Christians in the church, you have a church calling on the state to enforce discipline. It diluted the discipline in the church. It felt a need to materialize God through icons and pictures and statues and those kind of things. The veneration to and then later through angels, saints, those kind of things, which you see even today. Then you have, here you begin to have the veneration of Mary in 590. She becomes the Immaculate Conception in 1854, the Assumption in 1950, and her intercessory powers with Christ. And that's basically, you hear the term Mariology today. That's
what's the miraculous Assumption? What's that mean?
Where she was taken up into heaven.
It's amazing, the legend something. Of Mary, how it's grown.
Yeah.
First, she was the virgin who miraculously conceived, and then 1,800 years later, she became the sinless virgin who miraculously conceived, never sinned, and never died, but was called up to God in the manner of Enoch.
That's what the 1950 thing is?
Yeah, well, she was taken up, yeah.
It's amazing that that happened so close to our time, because you can understand way back they did a whole lot of stuff. Here's something that's only 50 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, Protestants have too low a view of Mary, so let's start there, that Protestants act as if there's absolutely nothing special about the woman that God chose to be the mother of God. So there's something pretty remarkable about Mary, but it's remarkable because of God's grace, not because of her. But in Roman Catholic tradition, it's like a fish story that has just gotten incredible over time, where not only is she never sinned, but she never had sexual relations. She this categories of things that make her remarkable has grown, as if it's not enough just to say that God chose her to conceive as a virgin, the Son of God. You'd think that would be enough.
And the other thing, too, is you have to realize that the papacy begins to... It boxes itself in, because as it assumes more and more control and more power, it basically gives to itself the tenet that it cannot make an error. So then once you make a decision on something like this, you can't undo it, because obviously you couldn't have made an error. So that's what I'm saying. If you make a basic error and start off in a different direction, if you then box yourself in and say, well, I couldn't have made an error, as Paul was talking about a couple Wednesdays ago, I guess, about the humility of saying, well, I could be wrong, because we're all men. But when you start to claim that you are a descendant of the apostles and that therefore you cannot speak in error, then you box yourself in.
And that really is in the same way that we affirm from Scripture that Jesus was raised into heaven and seated at the right hand of the Father in the seat of power. The miraculous assumption doctrine is that Mary was called up into heaven and put in a seat of power by Jesus and made the queen of all things. I mean, it's that absurd. And I don't say that callously, but it's that absurd that she has taken this Christ-like exaltation.
When I was a little kid, back about 50, I saw a movie that showed that, and my mother was watching it with me, and she went ballistic. It showed that it was some religious movie showing Mary being brought up to heaven. I thought my mother was going to have a stroke.
It was probably church-produced propaganda to make this doctrine more believable.
Okay, what good came out of this? Orthodox Christianity was articulated, defended, and committed to writing. Because of all the heresies that were coming into the church, those first councils were talking about Orthodox theology, much of which we agree with today. Remember going back to the green bars that I was talking about before. And then we began to part ways further on. But the form of worship was refined, sacred music was broadened, raised the moral tone of society, dignity of women is raised. All of this we've talked about before. Slaves were given milder treatment. Roman legislation became more just, and the spread of missionary work was speeded up. All those are good things. But like all things that men do, there's often good things and bad things. But in God's providence, this is the things that He brought out of there. And God always has His remnant of people wherever they are. We have the visible and the invisible church. Now, the Catholics look at it a little differently. It's the visible church. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. What price did the church pay for that? The state demanded the right to interfere in the church. You have the struggle with power going on. You have the mass conversions. And it became a persecutor of others the same way it had been persecuted to start with. You would think that when the shoe was on the other foot, the church surely would have been more gracious. That's what you would think. Now we're to the apex of the papacy. Pope Gregory VII from 1023 to 1085. I'm going to talk a little bit about him. Just to put it in context, the Crusades were from 1095 to 1289. Then we're going to talk about Pope Innocent III. This man was probably the most powerful man ever. When you think about the fact that he controlled, in effect, the government and the spiritual power. Whoops. And then the Inquisitions, 1231 to 1860. It's hard to believe that they actually went on that long. But there were many Inquisitions that happened. We're going to talk probably about four of them if we have time. Pope Gregory the Seventh. Name of Hildebrand. I don't know if you've ever heard that name before, but that was his name before he became Pope Gregory. The accomplishments in his time was he helped create the College of Cardinals. Remember we said that the laity, and especially the nobles and so forth, the aristocracy, tended to have a very important part in electing the Pope. Well, they wanted to get the secular authorities out of that, and so they created the College of the Cardinals to do the election of the popes. He claimed that he was the vice regent of God. It seems like each time you get a pope in there, they begin to elevate themselves a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more, and they continue to claim more and more power from a spiritual standpoint. He abolished lay investiture. Okay, this was where you had the various kingdoms and so forth, the various lay people were the ones appointing people to these bishoprics and so forth. They were having control over who was controlling in the church at these lower levels. And the Pope said, no, that needs to come directly from the church, not from the state. So he went against that.
And that was, just to connect that to our roots, the ability of a local congregation to have say in choosing their own minister was the primary motivating factor for the start of Presbyterianism in Scotland. The reason why the ARP ancestors broke from the Church of Scotland, in it was two groups, the Associates and the Seceders, but it was over this issue. Do members of a congregation have a right to have say in who their local minister is? And it had always been that way until here.
Mm-hmm. He believed the Pope was supreme over temporal rulers. In other words, he thought that the Pope should crown the king, not the other way around. He asserted the Pope's right to absolve subjects from their allegiance to temporal rulers. This was a big deal. In other words, if you're king of a country and I say you're excommunicated, he could say, well, fooey on you. But at the same time, if I tell all your subjects they no longer have to obey you, then all of a sudden you're without support. That was why this was a big deal. Try to eradicate clerical marriage and simony. So again, they're trying to completely do away with marriage. Remember I said in the Eastern Church, they allowed the lower levels of priests to marry, but not the patriarchs. Simony is the purchase of a church office. In other words, someone paid money to have your son or whatever go into a particular monastery or bishopric or something like that. Yes, Hank?
So if the lower levels were allowed to marry but not the higher levels...
In the Eastern Church.
Right, in the Eastern Church. How did the lower levels become higher levels?
Just because you're allowed to marry doesn't mean you do.
So you would need to not have chosen not to marry.
But you know, for a long time the rule was that if you were married before, you could stay married. You just couldn't marry once you got into that office. But over a couple hundred years, what it turned into was you were making a choice. And if you did marry, you were done moving up the corporate ladder.
Yeah. And he humiliated the Roman Emperor Henry IV. And he died in exile, but he set the stage. He really didn't see the fruits of all that he had accomplished for the papacy. And that came a little bit later, but he set the stage for that, even though he died in exile. And we're getting ready to talk about that in just a minute. I don't know if you've ever seen this picture before, but this is Henry IV, the Holy Roman Emperor from Germany, standing outside the door of a castle. The Pope is on the other side of the door, Gregory. He stood there for the Pope allowed him to stand there for 3 days, supposedly no shoes and the snow and the cold and everything else. He was seeking forgiveness from the Pope. Because the Pope had excommunicated him, just like I was telling you before. The Pope excommunicated him and told his folks, his people, you don't have to obey him anymore. And they didn't. Because the lower ranking secular authorities really weren't all crazy about Henry IV to start with. So Henry IV was kind of in a box. So he said, well, okay, I'll humble myself and go to the Pope. So he did that. And the Pope made him wait and wait. Well, the Pope was thinking, okay, from a Christian standpoint, he's here, he's humbled himself, he seems contrite. I basically have no choice but to forgive him. Because he did everything he was asked to do. But he knew that if he did that, it would be the end of his papacy. And that's exactly what happened. It took a few years, but Henry got his forgiveness, was restored, and eventually they attacked Italy, and eventually threw Gregory out and put him into exile where he died. So Henry got his payback, and the papacy, but the papacy actually grew after that. So you can see people going in and out of the papacy because Henry would come in and they would appoint someone else to be pope. So you got, at one time, like I said, we had three popes going on and it's a mess. Yes, ma'am.
So was his excommunication a political move because the people underneath him?
This goes, okay, Henry, what Henry did, Henry was trying to appoint various ecclesial people into various offices, and the Pope said, no, we're going to do that. And Henry continued doing it, so he excommunicated him. So it was a big deal. But again, it set the stage for the power that the Pope would have later on as a result of that. Now we have Pope Innocent III. Okay, this was the true apex of the papacy at this point.
Can I ask a question real quick?
Yes, ma'am.
When did they start changing their name and why?
I don't know the answer to when. I think it was early. I think it was in the 5th or 6th century. The why is the same reason why it's good for me to be called pastor is to remember that my office is bigger than my personhood, and so it's an act of humility that you're submitting yourself to an office that's bigger than you, and so they're setting aside their individual personhood in a sense when they assume this office. And so they lose their name and they take a name of the church. And that represents, you know, just
wondering where some of these names came from, like Gregory. What does that have to do with it?
Church history from great saints in the first few centuries of the church. And and you see yourself as setting aside an individual identity and assuming a servant of the church identity. So the impetus behind it is good, probably unnecessary.
Leo humbled, Pope Innocent, excuse me, Innocent humbled the King Philip Augustus of France. He used an interdict. What an interdict is where the Pope goes to your country and he says, okay, it's kind of like a work slowdown, if you think about it. What they do is they say, okay, we're only going to do those things that are absolutely necessary, baptisms and the extreme unction. And maybe one or two Eucharists in a year. Well, of course, that gets the people all upset. Because as we'll talk a little bit longer, that's where your life comes from. It's from the church. It's from the sacraments. It's where you draw your spiritual life from. And when all of a sudden you withdraw those, people get really upset. So that's what he did. He used the interdict against the King of France. Then he went after the King of England, King John. And there he used the interdict, same thing, but he used the threat of the French people, the French king, going over to attack England. So he kind of had the King of France in his hip pocket as a threat. But this comes back to bite him. Or eventually, it bit the papacy. Defeated the Holy Roman Emperor Otto IV. This time he actually used the French army. He really used them against Otto and defeated him. Now, he didn't do it himself, but again, he had so much control over the temporal authorities that he was able to do that. He initiated the Crusades, him along with all the other people who were there, the cardinals. He defined the seven sacraments, including transubstantiation. Made confession necessary at least once a year. That's confession to a priest. He had to do that at least once a year. And he declared the penitential system as the only way of salvation. The penitential system is the seven sacraments and all that goes with that. How did the Pope see the church in the world? We've talked about this. Two legitimate powers, but he was the head. Their main mission was to save souls on the merit of Christ through grace mediated by the church. This was a big deal. This is not just a throwaway here. That was their main mission. Christ said, go into all the world. Make disciples. I think they took the word make a little literally, but saving grace comes to people through the sacraments. Baptism. Confirmation. Around 11 or 12. Penance, the Eucharist, marriage, extreme unction for illness or death. It's not just for death, it was originally for death, but it's also for illness now. And ordination of the priesthood. So there's a little something for everybody here. And when people look back at this and they saw extreme
last rites. You familiar with that phrase?
But it's not just for last rites, because if you're sick and stuff, they have there's another term that they use besides unction. I can't remember it. There's another term that they use, but they can use it for sickness as well. That may not be unto death, but they do use it. That was a change that they have made more recently. Yes, ma'am.
If marriage was such a sacrament through which saving grace would come, you know, part of the sacraments, then why couldn't the priests be married? Would the priests need the saving grace even more than everybody else?
They have ordination.
Yeah. But there's actually another thing in there that's not quite as spiritual. One of the reasons that they didn't want the priest to marry is so that they wouldn't have a family and then have sons that they would then pass this on to. The priesthood wouldn't be passed familially. That was one reason I found about why they did not want the priest to marry. But also, from a very spiritual point of view, that they could concentrate on serving the people and serving God. So, sacraments. They have seven, we have two. They say that their sacraments are instituted by Christ and entrusted to the church, by which divine life is dispensed to us. The visible rites by which the sacraments are celebrated signify and make present the graces proper to each sacrament. They bear fruit in those who receive them with the required dispositions. We say that they are signs and seals of the covenant, and that the grace which is exhibited or by the sacraments rightly used, this is from the Westminster Confession, is not conferred by any power in them, but upon the work of the Spirit and the word of institution, which contains together with a precept authorizing the use thereof, promise of benefit. Promise of benefit.
Sir.
Yes.
Obviously, the Catholic and the Orthodox stuff have been there since the get-go, but those things back at that same time, there was no Protestant. This stuff on the right-hand side came about later after the Reformation, correct?
That is correct. Yeah, I'm putting them there for comparison.
Comparisons. But they weren't the same time.
Exactly. Just like I was showing those green and red lines and everything, just kind of extrapolating back and saying this is where we are today. Okay? So, questions. Why do Protestants only have two sacraments? Wouldn't more be better?
More
is always better, isn't it? Why do we just have two? Pardon me?
Two in the Bible, right?
Well, the Catholics would show you some scripture references that they say. Now, they would interpret it to say it's in the Bible.
Is it marriage in the Bible?
Yes, ma'am.
Don't talk about marriage and what they're talking about.
Christ didn't command us to be married. He commanded us to follow the Lord's
Supper,
and he commanded us to be baptized.
Yes.
Do this.
Yeah.
And the context of their institution is a big deal, too. The sacraments were given by Christ to the church, not to individuals, not as part of the creation. They were given by Christ to his church in that context. You can't say that about marriage. Marriage is given to the world, not to the church. And marriage is given in the creation order, not in the establishment of the church. And the only two things that you can make that argument about where Christ gives them directly to the church are baptism and the Lord's Supper. And even baptism you have to nuance, because there's the baptism of John, which is distinct from the baptism of Jesus. Those are two different kinds of baptism that Scripture teaches of. And so Jesus gives us the baptism that the church has, which is not the same as the baptisms of the Old Testament or the baptism of John. So that context in which they're given is a big deal.
Let me back up here just a minute. Each of these has a distinct purpose. Baptism would be equated to essentially regeneration. The way we would see regeneration takes place before you have faith, and that even that faith comes from God. But the baptism is salvific to them, because that is grace that is put in. In essence, I guess it gets you to zero. Is that sort of how they look at it?
Let me use the board.
Okay.
We'll get stuck here.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry for taking over.
No, all please right. Do.
When you're born and you come into this world, in the Roman Catholic Church, you have original sin. We all agree, Protestants and Catholics, on the doctrine of original sin. So when you're born into this world, when you look at the ledger of your life, I need a better marker. At the moment you're born, your ledger has a negative balance. This is what I get for letting my child draw with these markers. Yeah, all right. Alright, so this is Paul's ledger, alright? And when Paul's born, he inherits a negative balance from Adam. When I die, whatever point that is in my life, if I want to go to heaven and be with Christ, I must have a positive balance. It doesn't matter how positive it is. It can be plus one, like I will have. It can be plus 1,000,000, like really holy people have. But I've got to have a positive balance. There is nothing you can do in your entire life that will overcome your failure to be baptized. So that's step one. When you are baptized, you move from a negative balance to a zero balance. We'll use that phrase that Vernon used. No matter what you would do for the rest of your life, if you fail to be baptized, you're done. Okay? It's that significant. So in one sense, you can say, does baptism save you? No. But is it possible to be saved without baptism? No. To be baptized is to be brought into the church. And there is no salvation outside of the church. Remember when we talked about that in church history? That becomes established as a fundamental doctrine. There is no salvation outside of the church. Baptism is the way into the church, so without baptism, you are not going to be saved. How does that play out practically? Go over to Presbyterian Hospital and go into the NICU ward. For non-Catholics, the most important thing that happens for their dying infant is that you pray. For Catholics, the most important thing that happens is that child be baptized. And they will call in the priest, or they will call in the Catholic chaplain, and that child must be baptized, even if that child is dead. That child must be baptized. So that's one of the ways that this plays out practically. Now, how do you get from zero to positive? This is going to be a gross oversimplification, and if you want to talk about details later, we can talk about it. You can trade grace for righteousness. Okay? If you can get grace, you can trade it for righteousness. How do you get grace? Now, we agree with how do you get grace through the sacraments. We agree with that, right? But you can trade grace for righteousness. So all those things will contribute to your positive balance. Oh, well, good one. Thank you, Christine. How do you get negative balance?
Sin.
Who sins? Everybody sins. Catholic and Protestant acknowledge that. Everybody sins. How do you deal with the negative balance of sin? You need grace. You need to trade grace for righteousness. In addition to sacraments, there are some other things that get added. Blessings. Why is it such a big deal when the Pope walks through the town square of Vatican City and he sprinkles water on people?
It gives us a positive.
Grace! You can trade that grace for righteousness. Why is gazing on relics such a big deal? Oh, I had a chance to see one of the nails from the cross of Jesus. Grace, you can trade it for righteousness. Penance. Going to confession, confessing your sin to a priest, and a priest telling you, all right, pray this number of prayers and do this many hours of community service. Why is that a big deal? Grace. Grace gets traded for righteousness. Now,
indulgences.
Indulgences. You can just flat out buy it.
And the indulgences come from the treasury of merit. When we had the early church fathers that we've talked about, they built up merit out there because it's available to the whole church. They can then, like he's talking about, trade. They can actually have transactions with this merit. That's where these indulgences come from. And said, I can give you, if you go do this in the Crusades, I can give you some merit.
Let's say 1 million is the number that you actually need to get into heaven. There are people out there, the great saints of the church, who got more righteousness than they needed. So it's stored up in the treasury of the church, and it can be sold or it can be given away. Because you've got to get this grace so that you can turn it into righteousness. So, you're baptized and that puts you at zero. You participate in the life of the church and receive grace through the sacraments. You sin. You get these other things. And when you die, you're going to have a total number. All this math averaged out. So let's say your total number is 565,241. When you die, that was your total. But I said, you got to have a million to get into heaven. What doctrine do we need to create now?
Purgatory.
Why? Because there has got to be an opportunity for me to get from 565,000 to 1 million. How long you spend in purgatory is entirely dependent upon whether your number was 500,000 or 900,000 when you die. If you were baptized and you did one good thing in your whole life and everything else was sin and your number was one, you're still going to go to heaven because you're connected to the church. But it's going to take you a very long time to get there because you've got to get from 1 to 1 million in purgatory. Helen?
Does the priest keep track of these things?
No. God keeps track of these things.
Yeah.
You don't know what your number is.
We never know how long our loved ones are.
I mean, I know what my number is. No, you never know what your number is. And that's why do Roman Catholics pray for their dead relatives? Maybe their prayers can help move them up a few notches. And I don't say this to be flippant.
Right.
This is very serious business. But this is the system that they're taught into. Is that you've got to get this magic number, whatever it is, to get into heaven. And if you didn't get there in life, you've got to get there in death. And purgatory is a place of punishment. It's a place of suffering. But you're paying for your sins so that this number increases, so that eventually you get here.
So they believe in universalism. I mean, everybody's going to heaven one day.
No. Everybody who's connected to the church.
The church.
There's no salvation outside of the church.
That's why.
Everybody that's in the church is going to make it.
Everybody who's baptized into the church.
Yes. Make it, but
eventually.
They don't have that distinction.
Okay.
When you talk to a Roman Catholic and you say things like visible or invisible church, it's a distinction that has no meaning for them.
Right.
You're either in the church or you're not. And if you're in the church, which is by baptism, you'll be here eventually. I kill time.
That's fine.
You know, that gives no meaning to your numbers up.
Yeah. You better hope your numbers up.
But the thing of it, what it does though, is it makes you understand why the average person, when the church threatened them with excommunication,
exactly,
your eternal soul was on the line.
And not just the average person. The king
the,
of
the
France,
king.
When the Pope says, if you don't send your army to attack England, I'm excommunicating you from the church. Well, remember, in that structure, excommunication undoes baptism. It disconnects you from the church. There's nothing you could ever do. There's nothing. There's no hope.
That's what a German guy stood outside the door
for 3 days in the cold.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Or if someone said, well, if you go on this crusade, we can give you some additional merit so that you don't have to spend as much time as you thought you were going to have to spend in purgatory, for example.
Now let's be very fair. The Protestant church has radically fallen off the other side of this horse. And the Protestants act like the church doesn't matter at all. It's me and Jesus. Mm-hmm. And if I know that I'm right with Jesus, that's all that matters. The church doesn't matter a bit. That's not what Jesus said either. But you can see how these little things where the church, because of its quest for power, starts to control the means of grace and then says that these means are the only way that you could be saved, how that causes all of these other doctrines to get created that solidify this power.
Are all the infants baptized at the same time in the Catholic Church? Is there a set age or day?
There have been in times of history. Now it really varies. It's just as soon as possible is the goal. Now it's become such a pomp and circumstance kind of event. The same thing that it is for us, frankly, right? I'm guilty. We want to dress up our children and have our relatives there. And so now it's as much of a scheduling social event as anything else. But it is as little as possible, as soon as you can get them in. Because it's essential.
Maybe a dumb question. So, what about Catholic children who've been aborted? Do they go and baptize?
No, because if you were to admit to an abortion in any kind of faithful Catholic church, you're out anyway.
Right.